Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, get ready for this because it's genuinely surprising. Imagine a world-famous art institution, you know, incredible art, deep thinking, having its roots in something you probably have in your kitchen.
Go on.
Sugar. Seriously. We're talking about the Pate Galleries today. We're going deep into their history, some really unexpected facts, and of course, the amazing art.
Ah, the sugar connection, Henry Tate.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. So our mission here is to figure out how just one, okay, very generous donation grew into this whole empire of four galleries, each one quite different.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll look at how the Tate keeps shaping the art world, even London's economy, actually, and how it sort of changes how we all engage with art. Prepare for a few aha moments, I think, about art, buildings, giving.
And what's fascinating, I think, is how the Tate story really mirrors bigger cultural changes, you know, from Victorian times right up to contemporary art.
Right.
It says so much about how public galleries evolved, making art, well, accessible for everyone. It's a great story of vision, really.
Definitely. And we've got some great material to dig into histories of each gallery, some odd facts, insights into famous collections. So let's jump in.
Let's do it.
Okay, so to really get the Tate story, we have to start with that surprise ingredient, sugar. The man, Henry Tate. A sugar merchant, an industrialist.
Kate and Lyle. You still see the name everywhere.
You do. And he was quite the entrepreneur, apparently. Started his first grocery store aged just 20. Had six by the time he was 35.
Wow. Building an empire early on.
Right. But it was the sugar fortune that let him do something huge for British culture.
Okay, so the big moment.
1897. Henry Tate funds the first building. It was called the National Gallery of British Art back then.
And the location. Millbank Prison, wasn't it? The old site.
That's the one, in Pimlico, London. And it wasn't just the money for the bricks and mortar. He gave his own art, too.
His personal collection, yeah. 65 paintings, I believe. That was the seed collection.
Exactly. A pretty substantial seed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of philanthropy from an industrialist like Tate was, well, hugely important back then. It wasn't just a building. It was the foundation for a public art collection.
Which has just grown and grown.
Exponentially. And his taste, it leaned towards British Victorian art, didn't it? The Pre-Raphaelites.
That's right. Those incredibly detailed paintings, often based on myths or literature.
Mm-hmm. Think John Everett Millais' Ophelia, you know the one, floating in the water?
Oh, yeah. Iconic.
And J.W. Waterhouse's Lady of Shalott. Those are part of that initial gift, or certainly the style he favored. Giving that kind of private wealth for public good, it really set a precedent.
So how did that first gallery become the Tate we know now? Because it wasn't independent at first, was it?
No, not at all. It actually started life as an annex, sort of a branch of the National Gallery.
The one in Trafalgar Square.
Right. And the National Gallery controlled it until 1954. Quite a long time.
And people just started calling it Tate.
Pretty much. The public just, you know, shortened it.
Yeah.
Practical. And the name stuck, thankfully. Easier than National Gallery of British Art, Millbank branch.
Ah, definitely. But then the collection started to change, right? It didn't stay just British.
No, pretty early on, actually. Early 1900s. There was a bit of controversy, I think, when they acquired a collection of international contemporary art.
Oh. What was the controversy?
It was apparently meant for Dublin. So acquiring it for London was a big deal and, caused a stir. But it was a huge step.
Because it broadened the scope beyond just British artists.
Exactly. It really signaled the direction Tate would eventually go in, embracing a much wider, more international view of art.
Which ultimately led to needing more space, I guess.
Precisely. That shift, that growing appetite for modern global art. Well, it showed that one building wouldn't be enough. Foreshadowed the whole network we have today.
So let's talk about that network. Today, Tate isn't one gallery, it's four. A whole family. Shall we do a quick tour?
Yeah, let's bring them down.
Okay, first up, Tate Britain, the original, still there in Pimlico on the old prison site, opened 1897.
And its focus is still British art, right? From way back.
Yep, 1500 right up to today. It's the oldest, 102 years older than Tate Modern, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
And it holds the Turner collection. That's huge.
Oh, absolutely massive. JMW Turner left it to the nation. 180 oil paintings. And get this, 19,000 drawings and watercolors.
19,000? Wow.
I know. They built a special wing for it, the Clore Gallery, back in 1910.
Right. So that's the historic heart.
Okay. Then we head north to Tate Liverpool, opened in 1988.
In the Albert Docks. Very distinctive location.
Yeah, really transformed that area. It was called the Tate of the North initially. The idea was for it to have its own vibe, maybe reach a younger crowd, strong focus on education.
And the cafe. designed by Peter Blake.
Yes, Sir Peter Blake, Mr. Pop Art himself. How cool is that?
Very cool. And Liverpool hosted the Turner Prize, didn't it?
It did, in 2007. That was a big deal the first time the prize was held outside London.
Timed perfectly with Liverpool being European capital of culture in 2008, too.
Exactly. Put it firmly on the map. And they show international stuff, too, right? Like that German and American collection.
Yeah, the Froelich Collection in 99, Bose, Warhol, Richter, showing its global contemporary credentials.
Okay, next stop, the seaside. Tate St. Ives in Cornwall.
Beautiful spot, opened in 93.
Chosen because of the connection to Barbara Hepworth, the sculptor. Her studio museum is there, too.
Right, the whole St. Ives modernist art scene connection.
And the building itself is on an old gasworks site overlooking Porthmere Beach. Imagine working there.
Stunning. And funding for this one was more community-based.
Yeah, a mixed local community, the Henry Moore Foundation, European funding. And it mainly shows art from the main Tate collection, but specifically artists with links to the area.
Makes sense. Keep that local connection strong.
And it's been super successful. It gets like 240,000 visitors a year. They even had to expand it recently, finished in 2017. They've shown work related to Virginia Woolf, Patrick Heron, Amy Siegel.
So a real regional powerhouse, drawing on the main collection, but with its own focus.
Exactly. Which brings us to the final one, the big one, Tate Modern.
Ah, yes. The youngest, but probably the most famous globally now.
Totally. Opened in 2000. And we should probably spend a bit more time on this one because its story is pretty revolutionary.
Agreed.
So Tate Modern basically came about because Tate Britain was just running out of space for all the modern and contemporary art it was collecting.
The collection was outgrowing the building. A good problem to have, I suppose.
Right. So they decided to split things. Tate Britain keeps the historical British art from 1500 onwards.
And Tate Modern gets the international stuff from 1900 to the present day.
Yeah.
A dedicated home for modernism and beyond.
And the building. Wow. The former Bankside Power Station.
Iconic. Right across the river from St. Paul's Cathedral. You can't miss it.
Many people say the building is the gallery's biggest artwork. It's inseparable from the experience.
Absolutely. They bought the site with a 12 million pound grant. Held a competition.
Won by Herzog and de Meuron, Swiss architects.
Yeah, and their genius was keeping so much of the original building's character, not just wiping the slate clean.
Right, that massive turbine hall, 35 meters high, became the entrance. Just staggering space.
And the old boiler house turned into the gallery spaces. Work started in 96, opened in 2000, and it just, well, exploded onto the scene.
Exploded is right. It's the second most popular museum in the UK, over 6 million visitors in 2019.
Incredible numbers. And the economic impact for London, around 100 million a year. It often gets more visitors than Tate Britain, actually.
Which is interesting, isn't it? The younger siblings stealing the limelight.
Well, contemporary art has a huge draw. And that building.
True. Plus, the main collection is free to enter, which is amazing. Big special exhibitions are ticketed, obviously.
Standard practice.
And the names you see there, Warhol, Lichtenstein, Picasso, Matisse, Rothko, giants. They had a big Warhol show in 2020 from his foundation.
And they have a great Kandinsky collection, too, showing his development. You can see his influence on Picasso and Matisse right there.
It's funny, though, you mentioned Tate Britain used to show some of this stuff, like that collection with Renoir and Van Gogh back in the 60s.
Yeah, the John Hay Whitney collection. It shows the demand was there long before Tate Modern existed. The pressure was building for a dedicated space.
Okay, so beyond the amazing building, Tate Modern does something really different with how it shows the art, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. It's quite radical, really, their whole curatorial philosophy.
They display it thematically, not chronologically. Explain that a bit.
Right. So instead of walking through rooms ordered by date 1910, then 1920, then 1930, you might walk into a room exploring a theme, like artists and society, or materials and objects.
And a piece from, say, 1900 could be right next to something made last year.
Exactly. If the curators feel they connect thematically, they put them together. It creates these amazing dialogues across time.
And they change these themes around. It's not fixed.
No, they refresh the displays every 5 years or so. Keeps it dynamic. Back in 2000, the themes were things like History Memory Society or Nude Action Body. Later, maybe poetry and dream or energy and process.
Always finding new connections.
Precisely. And some pairings are just brilliant. One famous example is hanging Monet's water lilies near a Mark Rothko painting.
Monet and Rothko. Seems like an odd couple.
On the surface, maybe. But it lets you see how both artists, in totally different ways, were obsessed with capturing light and atmosphere. It makes you look at both works differently.
That's fascinating. It forces you to think more rather than just following a timeline.
Exactly.
And the experience isn't just the art, right? There's more to Tate Modern.
Oh, yeah. It's got one of the best art bookshops in the country. Seriously dangerous for the wallet.
Huh, bet.
And the views. From the kitchen and bar up on the sixth floor, you get these incredible panoramas over London. St. Paul's is right there across the river.
Nice. And a travel tip for getting between Tate Modern and Tate Britain.
Ah, yes, the ferry. There's a dedicated boat service, takes about 25 minutes, sails right along the Thames, past all the landmarks.
Much better than the tube.
Way more scenic. Beats a 40-minute walk or figuring out the underground, that's for sure. A lovely little journey in itself.
Sounds like a plan.
So this thematic approach at Tate Modern, it's not just quirky, is it? It has a real purpose.
You mean in how it makes us understand art?
Yeah. It kind of breaks down those rigid art historical categories. It encourages you, the visitor, to make your own connections, to think critically.
Instead of just being told this came after that.
Exactly. It reflects the sheer diversity of art, from huge installations in the Turbine Hall to quieter pieces upstairs. It challenges you, which I think is great.
Okay, so stepping back from the individual galleries, let's think about the whole Tate collection. It's enormous.
It really is. Over 65,000 artworks as of now, dating right back to 1500.
And covering everything, painting, sculpture, photos, video, sound, even performance and digital stuff now.
It has to keep evolving. And the amazing thing is, you can see the entire collection online.
The whole thing.
Pretty much. Obviously, not everything is on display at once in the galleries.
Right. Some works are loaned out to St. Ives or Liverpool.
Yeah, or other galleries entirely. Or they might be in storage or conservation.
Yeah.
But the digital access is incredible. Truly global reach.
And keeping this collection growing and keeping the galleries free. That takes support, doesn't it? That brings us to the Tate members.
Ah, yes. Originally, the Friends of Tate Gallery started way back in 1957.
And they actively raise money to buy new art.
They do. Significant pieces. Like, they helped acquire Picasso's Weeping Woman. Their contributions are vital for keeping the collection growing and, crucially, supporting that free admission policy.
So the spirit of philanthropy that started with Henry Tate, it continues through the members today.
Absolutely. It's a collective effort now. Public funding, private donation, membership support. That initial gesture from Tate has been amplified over generations. It shows a real belief that this stuff, art, knowledge, beauty, matters most when it's shared.
So there we have it. From sugar cubes to a global cultural force. That's the Tate.
Quite a journey.
We hope listening to this has given you a new angle on how art, buildings, history, even business, all weave together to create these incredible public spaces.
Definitely. And the Tate story really shows how places can be reinvented, how industrial relics like a power station or a gasworks can become these buzzing hubs of creativity.
Yeah.
It proves art isn't just something static in a frame. It changes, adapts, reflects us back to ourselves.
Yeah.
Both in what it shows and how we get to see it.
So maybe next time you walk past an interesting old building or even look at a painting, think about its hidden story, its journey.
Where it came from, what it could become.
Yeah. And here's a final thought to leave you with. If a massive power station can become one of the world's leading art galleries, what other ordinary, maybe overlooked structures in your own town or city have that kind of hidden potential, just waiting for a new purpose?
Food for thought.
Definitely. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.